versus NRA Interest of Shayla H. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, my name is Pat Carraher. I'm an attorney of Legal Aid of Nebraska. Our office represented the father of the children in this juvenile court case. In this case, the juvenile court judge took jurisdiction following a trial and placed legal custody of the three minor children with the state, placed them in foster care, and representing the father, I filed this appeal. In my brief, I set forth four arguments. Looking back on that, I think today I just want to focus on two of the arguments because I think two of them are especially compelling. One of them involves an argument that the judge erred in adjudicating this case when there wasn't certain language in the county attorney's petition. And the other argument that I'd like to focus on is the fact that there wasn't really expert testimony as part of the temporary custody hearing, the foster care placement. Regarding that first argument, I think there are some cases directly on point, the Dakota L case, the Sabrina B case, that say in a juvenile court case proceeding, when the Indian Child Welfare Act applies, there needs to be certain language set forth in the petition. And here, there was never any attempt to put that language in the petition. In fact, I'm somewhat at a loss because I'm not used to arguing a case where all the law is truly completely on my side. These are recent cases, Court of Appeals cases, Nebraska cases, and there's a complete lack of other cases on the other side.
Counsel, neither of those cases dealt specifically with a motion to dismiss under our new pleadings statutes. And you did make a motion to dismiss. I think it was at the end of the adjudication hearing.
That's correct. Okay.
One of the reasons that the court denied it was the timeliness of it. If you could address that for us, I would appreciate it.
And I understand that's one of the main arguments that the state is making. I guess I would have a couple of comments about the timeliness. First of all, I think it's kind of a matter of perspective. I think the judge and the state are looking at this as they filed the case and here's the trial, and I didn't make my argument until the end. You know, I step back and look at the big picture, and the trial stage is really just the beginning. This case may go on years. I think I objected at the beginning of the case. I made my argument at the trial stage. I think it's a timely objection. I filed a timely appeal. I know there's cases, and I think there's like Enrique T. that talks about somebody waiting years and then coming in trying to invalidate a case because of problems with ICWA. And I can understand that, but I didn't wait years. I did that at the trial stage. As I said in my brief, I don't know if I should have to make a pretrial motion just to make sure the state could correct the problem, to make sure that my client was prosecuted properly. I don't think that's my job as a defense attorney. I would also say, for example, the Sabrina B case talks about kind of the underlying reasons for this. It says, you know, these are elements, new elements that aren't in other cases. And you have to put the parties on notice of things. It talks about telling all the parties involved what the elements will be, the conduct of the case. And just because I didn't make a pretrial motion, does that mean all the other parties to this case, and there's mother and mother's attorney, father's attorney, guardian ad litem, caseworker, Department of Health and Human Services counsel, county attorney, judge, are all those parties then deprived of the benefit of having the facts set out and the guidance of the pleadings of how the case should be conducted? I don't think so. I would also say, I think, and I understand the court's comments that this was maybe before the new pleadings, but I don't think in Dakota at all the parent's attorney made any sort of pretrial motion. I think Sabrina B., parent's attorney, may have filed a demur.
There was a demur, yeah.
I don't feel that the case should turn on the fact that I raised it at trial instead of a pretrial motion.
Counsel, suppose we agree with you on this argument. Do you think the state has an opportunity to amend its petition or complaint, whichever the modern terminology is?
Certainly my first choice today would be if the court decide that adjudication was improper and dismiss the case and the parties would go on their way. But another option would be to remand and give the state a chance to amend their petition, and there may be some language in some of these cases that discusses that.
Is there any language supporting dismissal without an opportunity to amend Do you have any authority to cite to us to support that?
I do not.
Okay.
And I know the county attorney has made some arguments about kind of a waste of time going through this. If this court would render a decision that says the matter is remanded and the state needs to amend, I don't think that's a waste of time. I think that would be, you know, of tremendous value just to have an appellate decision that tells the juvenile court, hey, the Indian Child Welfare Act really does need to be followed. Decisions of the Court of Appeals need to be followed. And if the courts knew that, the parties knew that, it could put a whole new tenor on the outcome of the case. So I still think that would be a tremendous outcome, even if it means that we all just go back and do the matter over again.
Well, it didn't work the first time in your position. So I don't know. How many times do we tell them?
Well, I think that, if I could go back.
I have faith in your conviction that that would change.
If I could go back and have a Court of Appeals decision indicating that the Indian Child Welfare Act really ought to mean something, maybe I can convince the state, hey, you really do have to make active efforts. You really do have to look for a family member to place these children with. I mean, I really do think it would make a difference that it would not just be a waste of time and redoing the trial over again. I guess the other part of the argument that I want to focus on today, in addition to the ICWA language, is the issue of the social worker testifying as an expert. So that really didn't have to do with the trial phase. It had to do with temporary custody, the placement in foster care. And there are definitions of who can testify as an expert. First of all, the statute clearly says there needs to be expert witness testimony saying that continued custody with the parents would result in serious damage, emotional damage, before the children are removed. And as far as who can testify as an expert, three types of experts. One is a tribe member. Here, the caseworker can testify, clearly not a tribe member. Secondly, a lay person with substantial knowledge of Native American culture could read the record. I think there are maybe one or two questions as foundation on this, something like, have you ever worked with Native American families? And she said, well, I've had some on my caseload. I don't think that lays a foundation to testify as an expert with substantial knowledge of Native American culture. The third type of expert is a professional with expertise in their specialty. Here, caseworker, fine caseworker, bachelor's degree in human development. I just don't think that qualifies her as a professional with expertise and specialty. Just for some other case, if I were suing for damages and wanted to prove my client had suffered serious emotional damage, and I put up on the stand someone with a bachelor's degree in human development and tried to have them give expert testimony on that issue, I think I would be laughed out of court.
Counsel, if you were to prevail on your first argument, and assuming the state got an opportunity to amend, do we even reach your second argument?
Well, if I were asked to draft an order, I would say that it would remand with directions and specifically to include a request that there be true expert testimony on the portion of the case involving the foster care placement.
Wouldn't there at least be the possibility, theoretically, that on remand they might bring out more qualifications of this individual?
And that's true, too. It would not necessarily have to be a difference, but at least more foundation be ready to show that this really is an expert. I don't think that would happen with this particular person, but again, if you look at the record, I just don't see how there was foundation laid to say that this person give expert testimony.
Are we entering into the territory, assuming the predicates that I've already expressed, are we entering into the territory of an advisory opinion?
I'm not sure if I can answer that. So I won't try to answer that. I don't think I can answer that question. I apologize.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please report, counsel. I am Deputy
You're asking the author, one of the author judges, to reverse her own opinion.
Yes, I understand that, but I still think that the issues that are brought up in the brief, as well as the change from code pleading to notice pleading, which occurred I believe in June of 2003, and Sabrina was a case that was I believe initially it was in the late 90s when that case was brought before the juvenile court. I think even the termination request was in the late 90s. So that case was prior to the change in the pleading requirements. There was a demur that was raised in that to dismiss the pleadings because it lacked sufficient allegations.
The motion to dismiss that we're under now is similar to the old demur, isn't it? I mean, as far as the analysis.
Well, I believe so. I believe
we're looking at whether it states a cause of action.
Yes, that is correct. And I think under notice requirements as they exist today, I think that the Mr. Hernandez had a sufficient notice what the allegations were regarding the abuse and neglect that the state would allege that these children were subjected to by he and his wife. So, in juvenile courts.
Well, is the analysis of whether the complaint states a cause of action one as to whether the party's notified of what the allegations are?
I think they were notified of what the allegations were. I guess.
Is that how we analyze a motion to dismiss for failure to state a cause of action?
I understand.
Well, you say that the father was notified of what the allegations were. Is that the standard by which we review a motion to dismiss for failure to state a cause of action?
Well, I guess it's a little unusual because generally, in Lancaster County, there's not usually an answer that's filed to the petition. Generally, there will be a time requirement which you have to answer that, and that is not the practice right now.
Well, but don't the rules provide if an answer is not required, which it's not in the juvenile court arena, then the motion to dismiss can be made at trial?
I believe that it should be made prior to the trial starting. I think that.
But what do the rules say?
Well, the statutes don't say anything about specific language being pleading, being pled. What the statutes indicate is that the state needs to show active efforts before removing a child that falls under the Removing Child Welfare Act. So the statutes, Sabrina was a termination case, and termination cases are different than an adjudication. At the adjudication stage, the state is proving that, these children are at risk of abuse and neglect. That's a separate issue as to whether or not children are going to be removed. And in the brief, it indicated that there are going to be situations where there could be an adjudication, children could fall under the Child Welfare Act, and there's not going to be any removal. I think that language in that instance is going to be unnecessary. It could be confusing to the parents. So as far as what statutes don't indicate anything. Dakota relied on Sabrina. Sabrina was a termination matter. And in terminations, the state does have to show evidence as to active efforts, what the state did to try to keep the family together. And so that is critical at termination because you are severing the rights. If you're severing the rights, this child is not going to be living with their parents anymore. And so in that situation, you do have to prove to the court that there were active and ongoing efforts to keep these children in the home. At the adjudication stage, there's nothing in the statute that indicates a requirement to plead anything specifically. What needs to be pled is what was in this case, what the allegations of abuse are, why these children fall within the court's jurisdiction, and that's what was proven during the trial. So I think
argument is there was a defect in the pleading on that stage, first I would ask this court to reverse the verdict, but if not that, then I would say in this case, because there was ample time to, the allegations were denied, that appeared, there was never any objection to the pleading for lure objections in both Sabrina and in Dakota. There was also an objection, I believe, in that case, the court, the attorney, mom didn't show up, so the attorney objected to going on the new filing, the amended petition, because he hadn't had a chance to discuss it. So the court said, well, then we'll go on the original one. Well, and I think, and the court also pointed out in that, well, if you've amended that petition, then that initial petition goes away. So, in that instance, I don't even know in Dakota if the court even needed to address it further, because really it wasn't proper to proceed on the initial petition because that petition no longer existed due to the amended petition. I do also want to address the issue of Ms. Billman being found to be a qualified expert witness. I believe that she is an expert. The Indian Bureau of Affairs.
Pass.
Yes. Setting forth kind of the qualifications, what she needs to be an expert, which was recited in Rebecca. And Ms. Billman clearly falls within that third prong. She is somebody that has specialized knowledge and education in this case. Again, I believe her testimony was that she had 17 weeks of initial training with the department, with 24 hours after that each year, a six-day training regarding the children's safety in the home, and she's been with the department for 11 years, and had dealt with Indian families during that time.
Let's not gloss over that. Did any of the foundational testimony discuss whether her training included anything with respect to ICWA? Is that?
No, I don't believe there was a specific, other than have you had to deal with.
That's experience afterwards, right? But as far as
it was during her 11 years that she had worked with Indian children. I guess what I would say in this case is there was no. The evidence that we have is that the children are eligible for enrollment, and therefore the Indian Child Welfare Act applies. There was nothing to attack Ms. Billman's, her expertise as to her qualifications. There wasn't another expert put up by the appellant.
Well, there was an objection to her opinion, wasn't there?
Yes, there was an objection to her opinion, but I don't believe that the testimony that was provided was clearly erroneous, that the juvenile court's finding that she qualified as an expert is clearly erroneous in this situation due to, those years of experience. And in this case, there is, other than the fact that they are eligible for enrollment, there's no indication that there's any cultural bias here, that they were involved with the tribe, that would have been helpful in this case, that there was some unique aspect of being an Indian child, something in their culture, that background, because they are Indian children, that maybe the rest of society would think is.
I just want to be sure that I understand, as I understand the record regarding the foundational testimony for this witness's education and training, not talking about experience, I'm talking about education and training, there's nothing in this record that indicates that either her education or training had anything to do with any Indian children, correct?
There was not a specific question asked that I can recall about Indian children.
There was a focus on training for abuse and neglect, but nothing specific to Native Americans.
Yes, that is correct. Again, in this case, there wasn't anything saying that these kids were associated, with the tribe or were doing anything.
Counsel, is there any case law that would support your position that as long as we have a generalized statement that, and as to expert, that isn't it just the fact that they're Indians and there's a heightened scrutiny in regards to the federal law involving Indian children, and I don't know that any case says that you have to make an offer of proof in effect to show that there's something special about these children. If they're Indian, they're Indian. Isn't that it?
Well, that is correct, but I think the issue is safety. It's really, is there a substantial risk of emotional, physical harm? And that's what the department is to assess. That's what Ms. Doman, that's what her experience relates to, is the safety of these children and whether or not it was safe to be in the parents' home. That's what the statute said needs to be looked at, is returning these kids to the parents' home, are they going to be, you know, is it going to affect their emotional and physical livelihood? And in this case, and that's what the questioning was targeted at. I'm sorry, I'm over, so submit it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
How much time is remaining for the appellant?
I would just make a brief comment. This Britain B case does talk about the ICWA language being essential factors mandated by ICWA, and it talks about that language being a material element. So I do think that if it rises to that level, if these allegations are material elements of the state's petition, and they're not in the state's petition, then I don't think I waived anything by not raising that issue.
Thank you, counsel. You are excused and the case is submitted.